what is the ranch dressing rule and what is its importance for communication? Well, the ranch dressing rule is, the short version of it is that it doesn't matter how clear you are, probably a lot of people are still not going to understand. And the example I give, and the reason I call it the ranch dressing rule, is that I made up an example of, you write a story, and in this story, two people are going to go to dinner. And one person says to the other, where would you like to go to dinner? And the second person says, you know, I don't care as long as I don't have to eat ranch dressing because I hate ranch dressing. And then they go to a restaurant and they walk in, the server comes over and says, what would you like for dinner? And the one character says, you know, I don't actually care as long as I don't have ranch dressing because I hate ranch dressing. The server says, that's great because we have plenty of things besides ranch dressing. And out comes a salad a little while later. And what do you know? The person's salad has ranch dressing on it. So he calls the server over, says, I'm sorry, I hate ranch dressing. Can you please take this back and give me any other dressing because I hate ranch dressing? And the server says, 1,000 apologies for serving you ranch dressing because I know you hate ranch dressing. Takes it away, brings back another salad, says, how is this? And the person says, this is perfect because there's no ranch dressing and I hate ranch dressing. They have the meal, they walk out, and the person says, what'd you think of dinner? And the other person says, it was great because I didn't have any ranch dressing and I hate ranch dressing. Okay, so this is the complete story. At the end of the story, I guarantee that some readers will say, wait, are you trying to say he doesn't like potato salad? The point is that no matter how clear you are, a significant portion of people are going to completely misunderstand what you are trying to say. And by saying this, I am not attempting to disrespect readers unless I am also disrespecting myself, because I do this myself too. This happens. I can't tell you how many movies I've been watching, like it's a thriller or something, and I don't get the point of the thriller because when some character dies two-thirds of the way through, I'm going, wait a second, the guy who just died, is that the main character's brother or is that that character who was in the office two scenes ago? They look kind of alike to me. I can't figure out which it is. And this is why in all those 1950s Westerns, they would have the good people wear white hats. It's like, oh, okay, a bad guy just got killed because he's wearing a black hat. I can stay with the story. We get easily confused, and this happens all the time. This is, I think, the source of significant interpersonal conflict is not simply people having a conflict, but not understanding what the hell each one's saying. And a great example of this, and it's sometimes because we bring our own baggage. And a great example of this is, I was at my mom's one time, and I was doing laundry, and I had washed some towels, and I was folding them, and my mom came over and said, would you like some help? And that's what she said. What I heard was, you're doing this wrong, and I'm going to show you how to do it right. And so the conversation went, would you like some help folding your towels? No! Okay. And the point is that there was all this, I didn't actually hear her say, would you like some help with folding your towels? And that happens all the time. Another great example of this is, I wrote Endgame, in which I was as clear as I could try to be. And it's like 1,100 pages of how this culture is killing the planet. And because in there, I say that sometimes it's okay to fight back, there are a lot of people that that's the only thing they hear. And so I've made jokes that I should have put out a version of Endgame called Endgame for Pacifists that consists of 1,100 blank pages and one page in the middle that says sometimes it's okay to fight back, because that's all they heard. So this is one reason. Well, before I go there, there's another thing that's important, which is that I think another reason this happens is not only because everybody brings their own stuff to it. So I remember, actually, I'm going to go a different direction for a moment, that I remember in high school, our advanced placement English teacher talking about something along these lines. And she was saying how much interpretation we bring to everything we hear. And the example she used is one person can say, "I love you," to another person, and the other person can hear many different things. That saying, "I love you," can mean, "I want to spend the rest of my life with you." Saying, "I love you," can mean, you know, "You're fun to hang out with." Saying, "I love you," could mean, "I am very attracted to you, and I don't really want to spend time with you, but it would be nice to do something." It can mean all, so there we go. What does "do something" mean? You know, it's like there are all sorts of interpretations. I remember she went on, and this was actually quite a good thing for a bunch of high school seniors to hear, that if somebody says, "I love you," what does that actually mean? And so there's a lot of this interpretation can come along with it. And that's one reason that we can, you know, two people say, "I love you," from two entirely different histories, and it can mean two radically different things, even with those three little words. And one person could say it casually, one person could say it to only one person in their life. So that's just with three words. Think what happens when you combine this with an entire political philosophy. And then there's another thing that can happen too, which is, I remember somebody saying once that it takes 10 years to change your mind. And his example, I read this in some book, and his example was that he found himself arguing very strongly, he was very strongly anti-choice, and then with no discernible transition, he found himself 10 years later arguing very strongly pro-choice. It's like, wow, it took me 10 years to figure this out, 10 years to change. I don't know when it happened. And I know for myself, it's not usually 10 years. It's usually a couple, 3 years. And one great example is when I first read and then talked to John Livingston, who was the one who introduced me to the notion that evolution is based primarily on cooperation, not on competition. I read that and I remember thinking, he's nuts. Everybody knows that evolution is based on competition. I mean, that's just obvious, isn't it? And when I interviewed him, I didn't challenge him on it because he was my elder. And I, you know, it also makes bad interviews to really challenge people. Instead, you want to really get their best material, you ask them questions that they can really deal with. And so I asked him nicely about it, but I was thinking, gosh, this doesn't make any sense to me. And then about 2 years later, I could no longer conceptualize evolution that didn't have cooperation as a central role to it. And there was no discernible transition. And so that is another reason for the ranch dressing lesson, is that people can have, you know, you can make a point very, very clearly. And, you know, there's that saying, when the student is ready, the teacher will appear. And likewise, if the student isn't ready, the teacher can appear, and the student's like, "I don't like what you have to say." It's you know, I've thought about this a lot too, because I was raised a fundamentalist Christian, and I started evolving out of that when I was in junior high, and then much more in high school. Like, I was raised Seventh-day Adventist, and you follow the Old Testament rules as well as the New Testament rules, so you don't eat pork, for example. And I still remember in high school my very first ham and cheese sandwich. It was so good. It's like they say about crack. I have been searching for that ham and cheese sandwich for the last 30 years just to reproduce it. Anyway, the point is that I was evolving out of Christianity in junior high and high school. And then by college, I'd pretty much jettisoned a lot of it. But I know that had I read my books when I was in high school, I would have hated them and they would have scared me. Had I read them in college, they would have troubled me. Had I read them when I was 22 and 23, I would have been so very hungry for them. And that's because Ursula Le Guin has this great line about writing is a lot like sex. It's a lot better with two people. And the point is that there are two people who bring things to the book. When I read a book, I bring my history as a reader to the book, and I bring my preconceptions. And then this is especially true when you're talking about very, very difficult things like bringing down civilization. And this is one reason my books are so long, not simply because I have the Stephen King disease. My books are long because I am attempting to get past people's defenses and to get them to switch their loyalty from this culture to the natural world. And I'm attempting to get them to decolonize. And I know that in my own process of decolonization, in many cases, I had to be dragged kicking and screaming, and I would find every objection I could until I was ready to hear it. I would find every objection I could. And so when I write my books, I am attempting to say it and then say it and then say it in a different way and then find this objection, respond to it, find that objection, respond to it, and anticipate every objection before it comes up. And another thing that has to do with this is I was reading Beyond Geography by Frederick Turner. Great, great book. And in this book, this also is one reason that I repeat myself in my work is because he did this thing in there where Christopher Columbus, his name means the cross bearer, Christopher. And he kept saying all through, he kept calling, he didn't just mention it once on page 43, but all through the book. And the book is really about how Christianity is a linear religion as opposed to a cyclical religion. And that was one reason that it leads inevitably to genocide against indigenous people. And he keeps talking about Christopher Columbus, the crossbearer. And I went through this very interesting process. The first time he mentions, like, oh, that's interesting. And then he mentions it 20 pages later. And I'm like, well, it's still interesting. He mentions it a few more times. And I'm like, you know, you've mentioned this a lot. I get it. And I started getting annoyed. And then about halfway through the book, it's like, no, I really get it now. And he had to push me through that resistance to it until I understood that Christopher Columbus was carrying the cross of Christianity to give to the indigenous people and on which to crucify them. And that this is, it all held together. And the point is, it was through that repetition that I was able to finally get it. And had he stopped after two or three repetitions, I would not have fully gotten this point. I would not have gotten the ranch dressing lesson. I would have thought, oh, that's an interesting coincidence that Christopher Columbus, his name means the cross bearer. Isn't that an interesting factoid that I can now share with all my friends and seem really smart? As opposed to getting the full implications. So what are the implications for this for our, well, there's another part I want to bring to this, which is because each reader brings his or her own stuff to the table, this is an argument for clarity, and it's also an argument to try to go back to first principles. And what I mean by first principles, I'll tell a quick story here. My rote memory has never been particularly good. And so in college, when we would have exams, and I got a degree in science, in physics, and oftentimes you would have to memorize formula for that. And I've always been terrible at that. And what I found quite often worked for me was to understand the first principles very well. And then instead of memorizing the formula, I could quickly rederive them. But what a first principle is the, I should have looked up this definition before we did this talk. Cut that out because that's going to sound silly. A first principle is basically the underlying principle from which everything else builds up. So, for example, humans are mammals is a first principle. And then you can build out from there that humans will have various characteristics associated with mammals. And there can be first principles too, like in Endgame. That's why I put the premises up front, is because one of the first principles is that if your way of life is based on the use of non-renewable resources, it won't last. It can't last. That's a first principle. If your way of life is based on hyper-exploitation of renewable resources, such that every year there are fewer of them than there were the year before, it won't last. That's a first principle. And so I think to try to overcome the ranch dressing lesson, we can A, be as clear as we can, put white hats, black hats, put, you know, do whatever we can, use everything we can to try to be clear. And the other thing we can do is attempt to understand our own first principles and to, to understand in when we communicate, to understand when we are speaking from first principles and when we are speaking from our own underlying prejudices. We try to understand our own prejudices coming in. We try to understand, you know, what baggage we bring. We try to understand, we try to go to first principles, and we try to be clear and say things as often as is required. And then in addition, I think we also need to give up on the notion that just because we say it clearly, that everyone's going to understand, because it's never going to happen. And, you know, over the years, there have been so many people who have written to me to say, you know, I really love the book Endgame, and because I read that book, it made me withdraw from all political action and to basically live on a commune. And I thought the point of Endgame was that our personal actions are not what is important, but instead that we need to have decisive political action against the system that is causing the atrocities. And I think it's really important, you know, that I've gotten that response a fair amount. So I need to also ask myself, was I clear enough? And in this case, I think the answer is yes. I think that perhaps the most important thing is that we need to just recognize that no matter how clear we are, that not always will people understand. And you do the very best you can, and then you give up. And if that person doesn't understand, you talk to somebody else. That's one of the good things, is that there are increasing numbers of people, when we talk specifically about bringing down civilization, talk about stopping this culture from killing the planet, there are increasing numbers of people who recognize these fundamental truths. And so if you're attempting to communicate with someone and they're really not getting it, that's actually okay, because you can't control what they understand and what they don't understand. Be as clear as you can. If they don't like it, talk to somebody else.